You are listening to a PERC podcast brought to you by the Property and Environment Research Center in Bozeman, Montana. As part of our Free Market Environmentalism Workshop, this episode features Dr. Jamie Brown discussing entrepreneurial finance and environmental innovation.
So thanks to Dino and PERC for inviting me back to Bozeman. It's a real pleasure to be back. I've got to say, though, I've been extremely nervous about this talk. This is true. The last talk I gave in Bozeman was at the public library, and it was on the financial crisis. And Andy was there, right? And I got heckled from the back. So this disgruntled accounting prof from MSU, I think, accused me of being part of the Bush-Greenspan conspiracy to wreck the economy. And I was terrified. It had never happened before, and so I've been sort of watching the back door to make sure this guy doesn't show up. I'm quite certain that this guy is not on the PERC mailing list, but you know, you never know. In any case, it's a pleasure to be here and talk about stuff that, you know, I've been thinking about in a slightly different context for several years, and I think extending what I've been doing and what others have been doing with regard to the financing of innovative activity and the role that access to finance plays in the amount of innovative and R&D investment that takes place in the economy. It's a natural extension to think about how access to finance affects environmentally friendly or environmental innovations. In fact, maybe it's a bit redundant to even talk about environmental innovation, because innovation itself is all about producing more with fewer inputs, using less. So when I talk about environmental innovation, what I really have in mind are the technological kind of breakthroughs that are going to help with any number of environmental issues. So I'm thinking very broadly here about technological development. And so just as a jumping off point, Jonathan Adler, who I know has been at PERC, has a Harvard Law Review article regarding using prizes to induce investment in technological innovation. And he, you know, in his abstract, he says, substantial technological innovation is required if the nations of the world are to come anywhere close to proposed emissions reduction targets. So what I want to think about today is why finance and the availability of finance might matter for having those innovations take place, for having investment in those technologies. So to start, in general, it's useful to think about why private rates of innovative investment in environmental innovation and innovation otherwise might not be high enough, at least from a social perspective. So this perspective doesn't have anything really to say about finance, and this is the way most people who are talking about environmental innovation, clean and green technologies, this is the framework they have in mind. They have in mind a world where private rates of investment aren't high enough because of appropriability concerns. So firms know that intellectual assets, they can't appropriate all of the profits from the intellectual assets and the technological knowledge that they develop. So up front, they invest less in the first place. And then the second, you know, consideration is that there may be substantial external benefits. Notice I did not use the term externality, just substantial external benefits that spill well beyond the firms and even the countries in which the technologies are developed. All right, so with this framework, even without thinking about finance at all, there's reason to believe that the social returns from more investment in developing these technologies are greater than the private returns, and I think this is what motivates public policy efforts to encourage private innovative investment, such as intellectual property protections to deal with the appropriability issue, tax subsidies, direct government grants to encourage private sector firms to invest more in R&D and innovation. What I want to talk about is yet another reason that private rates of investment might not be high enough and the role finance might play in helping us understand the amount of innovation that we observe. So to start, I mean, you know, most of us, if we come with an econ background, our prior might be that finance isn't all that important, or at least it's of second-order importance when we think about the amount of real activity that goes on in the economy. But in this setting, I think there are several reasons to think that finance will matter for important real activities. So just as a starting point, what kind of conditions would we need for finance to actually matter, for the amount of finance to actually affect the real stuff that we care about? I think two things. Number one, entrepreneurs don't have enough, entrepreneurs and firms don't have enough internal resources to fully fund all of their investment opportunities. So they've got ideas, they've got things they could do, but they don't have cash in the bank or cash flows to finance all of them. And then if they go to external suppliers of finance, it's costly. It's costly in the sense that the external supplier of funds demands a higher return than the individual entrepreneur would if they were investing their own funds. So when I'm thinking about, we don't have enough internal funds to make the investments, and then there's a wedge between the cost of internal funds and the cost of external funds. So costly external finance is what's key here, and there are several reasons to think that, particularly as it relates to innovative activity, environmental and otherwise, that external finance is going to be costly. So here are a few reasons. Number one, we're talking about ideas here in many cases. We're talking about scientists and engineers. We're talking about knowledge. These kinds of intellectual assets have limited collateral value. It's hard to go to the bank and put up this as collateral to secure funding. That's number one. And then number two, the information asymmetries are likely severe, particularly for these kinds of investments. And there are a couple reasons for this. Number one, it's high-tech stuff. It's tough to explain to an outside investor exactly what you're doing, what the likelihood of success is, and so forth. And then in addition, even if you could explain what you're up to, what the likelihood of success is, you might not want to, because you don't want the idea to leak out, and then you lose some of those returns. So you have incentives to protect your sort of proprietary knowledge. Then the last thing is, you know, it's costly to access external capital many times, particularly if we're talking about large sums of external capital from public markets. If you're a small firm, it just may be prohibitive to list on exchanges and raise funds through, say, an IPO. So for these reasons, we would probably expect, at least theoretically, to see some difference between the rate of return that an investor using their own funds would require and the rate of return an outside supplier of funds would demand. And then one last point. This is also one setting where the type of finance that's available for investment likely matters. Now, I don't think this gets quite enough attention, but when we're talking about investments with no collateral value, with maybe a really high risk of failure but extremely large upside returns, these are investments that it's going to be hard to raise a lot of debt to finance. People aren't going to want to make a loan to finance investment like this. So if we're thinking about the kind of external finance that's most relevant for innovative investment, it's probably equity. And in fact, if you look across firms and across countries, I mean, there's strong empirical evidence that leverage is much, much lower in R&D intensive and innovative intensive firms. So what happens when finance matters? I mean, what does it mean? Well, it means a few things, and I'll cycle back through this later. But number one, it means innovation is below privately optimal rates in a world where financing doesn't matter. So relative to the case where financing is plentiful, we have less investment than we otherwise would. That's the first thing it means. And if you think about this, what it means also is that the firms we see innovating are which firms? The firms that have substantial cash flows and that can finance the innovations internally. So in a world where finance matters, you're still going to see innovation. I mean, I don't want to act like there's going to be no innovation when there's costly external finance. The point is, the kind of innovation and where the innovation takes place is going to be affected. So we're going to have innovation, but it's probably going to be concentrated in larger cash flow rich kind of firms. So that's the first point. The second point is, when financing matters, when firms face costly external finance, then the amount that they invest is going to be sensitive to fluctuations in the supply or availability of finance. And I think this is going to be particularly true for the firms and innovations, right, that face the most costly external financing. which is small and young firms. They're not established. Information problems are most severe. They don't have the internal funds available to finance the investment on their own. And the same goes for the more novel, more risky, the harder to explain, the far-reaching kinds of innovations. Those are the firms and innovations that are going to be most affected by the supply of finance. The third thing is that there's some opportunity here. And you may be thinking, well, if there's profitable investment opportunities, shouldn't we come up with a way to finance them? And in fact, this is venture capital. I mean, venture capital funded a significant fraction of the 1980s and 1990s high-tech boom in the U.S. for precisely this reason. It was costly to access external funds for these firms. Venture capitalists specialized in understanding these businesses. They came up with, you know, ingenious ways to structure the financing so that they could finance firms that would not otherwise get funds. So there's an opportunity in the sense that there are some high return projects lying around that presumably aren't getting funded. So here's a picture to show. And these aren't as nice as John's pictures, but it's a picture nonetheless. So just to illustrate what I'm thinking about here, innovation with costly external finance. Put the marginal cost of funds and the marginal benefit of innovation or innovative investment on the y-axis. Put some quantity, dollar amount, on the x-axis. Did I say that right? Y and x. Internal finance is IF0. The marginal cost of internal funds is constant at marginal cost IF. Once the firm exhausts their internal funds, this is the wedge that I'm talking about. Then there's a jump. There's a jump because of these information problems, because of transactions costs, and so forth. And for firms with demand curves that are far enough out, for firms that have opportunities in excess of their internal funds, then you get some equilibrium level of investment, I0, that's less than what I'm calling this privately optimal level, I star. So what is I star? I star is the rate of innovative investment you would get if capital markets were perfect. It's the rate you would get if there were no imperfections in capital markets. By the way, it's also the rate you would get, of course, if internal funds were bigger than I star. All right? So this is what I have in mind, that the privately optimal rate is lower because of financing and nothing else. So financing itself is reducing the amount of investment that's undertaken. So, as I said before, what this means is that shocks to the availability of finance, changes in the supply of funds, are going to impact the amount of investment that takes place. So here is the classic test for the presence of economically important financing frictions. So the test for whether capital markets are working well is to say, what happens to investment when there's a shock to internal funds? So suppose internal funds go from IF0 to IF1, what happens to the equilibrium level of investment? Now, this is a hard test to actually implement, and interpreting the results are tricky, and there's controversy and so forth, but at least in theory, the prediction is clear. If finance matters, then investment goes up when internal funds do. If finance doesn't matter, internal funds jump around all day and investment doesn't change. Similarly, you could think about changes in the availability of external finance. For example, venture capital comes on the scene in the late 1970s, early 1980s because of some regulatory changes. Maybe because there's a bubble in the stock market, perhaps, in the 1990s that changes the availability of finance. For whatever reason, either the wedge goes down, the supply curve for external equity or external finance gets more elastic, but because of greater availability of external finance, you also see an increase in the equilibrium level of investment. And in this case, it's funded entirely by firms raising external funds. Okay? And then again, let me just emphasize, this story, this financing story, is only really relevant for firms with limited internal funds, but sufficiently high investment opportunities that they're constrained at the margin. So, what do we know empirically about whether finance matters? So I apologize for citing myself so many times, but I promise there is not a good substitute, or I would have used it. Okay, so existing evidence. We don't know anything specifically, as far as I know, about environmental innovations. But I don't think that's super important. Because the ideas that I'm talking about here with regard to innovation apply to environmental innovations as well. So there's substantial empirical evidence, Hall and Lerner survey this in 2010, that R&D investment in some firms is sensitive to cash flow shocks. That suggests that finance matters. It's tough to interpret the results sometimes, but it suggests that finance matters. Second, there's strong recent evidence of a link between external equity issues, so access to stock market financing in particular, and the amount of R&D and innovative investment that takes place, again, in some firms. And the in some firm things is important here because it helps establish your identification, right? Finance should matter, but it shouldn't matter for everybody, right? I mean, I'm not worried about General Electric and how much innovative investment they're doing. They can finance it on their own. I'm more interested in the startup company that hasn't sold anything yet and has no internal funds. Let's change the availability of funds and see how much they change their investment. And in fact, I don't know, somewhere between 20 to 30 cents of every dollar raised externally is funneled into R&D for younger and smaller firms. You know how much for larger and mature companies? None. Exactly as you would expect if finance matters. And by the way, what do you think they do with the rest of that dollar? Can you guess? So 20 to 30 cents goes into R&D. Let's say 50 cents goes into... What? They don't have that much. They could. It goes into cash. It goes into cash so that they can keep financing the R&D down the line. So I'm going to come back to this point in a minute. But one thing you have to think about when you study finance and R&D is we need to be thinking long-term supply here, because we would not expect firms to ramp R&D way up and way down with every little fluctuation in the supply of finance. And the reason is because R&D is people. It's scientists and engineers, and it's costly to make those adjustments year to year. So firms put some of the money they raise into new projects. The rest they set aside to finance projects down the line. And then looking cross-country, and in some sense this is what I'm most excited about, looking across countries with strong shareholder protections, with well-developed stock markets, we see firms in those countries with substantially higher long-run rates of R&D investment. Credit, market development, debt, unimportant, doesn't matter. Okay. And again, the effects are concentrated in smaller and younger firms. So what the evidence from financing R&D and innovation more generally suggests is that finance matters, and it matters primarily for smaller and younger companies, innovation in smaller and younger companies. So linking this back to environmental innovation, the first takeaway is, look, the availability of equity, external equity in particular, you know, the venture capital for environmental innovation should be very, very important for the rates of this technological development that we observe. So private equity and venture capital, I mean, that's the obvious market-based solution to this problem. But it has its limits. For one, the supply of venture capital can be a bit fickle. I mean, it jumps around a bit depending on how the economy's doing, depending on regulatory changes, and so forth. So, and in addition, venture capitalists tend to be focused on one sector or another. So, you know, of course, that's partially because that's where the returns are, but also what it means is there may not be enough of a steady supply of private equity and venture capital to fully get firms to iStar. That's the bottom line. So there are public efforts to do this, and that's a tricky thing to do, but this is sort of the justification for public efforts to directly finance innovative activity in younger and smaller firms, which I'm going to come back to that at the end. The second takeaway is stock market development, legal investor protections, that stuff should be extremely important for the amount of environmental innovation that we see. And market-based systems may have a big advantage over bank-based systems here, because bank-based systems are more about credit, and credit is not the preferred source of financing for innovation. You can use it to some extent, but it's not the preferred source. And again, because it's costly to adjust the amount of investment that we undertake, we need to be thinking here about how much finance there's available long-term so I can maintain this investment project. Taxes should matter as well. There's favorable tax treatment for debt in the U.S. tax code, but that's not going to be that important. We're talking about equity-dependent investments here, so tax rates and credits at the income level and at the capital gains level should matter as well, because they change that supply curve. They change that marginal cost of funds, and for firms constrained at the margin, we should see some impact. I don't know of any studies that show this, but that's what we should observe. One other point about where tax policy should matter. For constrained firms, there are two channels through which tax policy matters. Effects on the cost of capital, and also the amount of after-tax cash flow that's available for investment. So there's a quantity of funds channel where tax policy could matter. And this doesn't get discussed very much. What it suggests is taxes may matter more for innovative activity in constrained firms than we think otherwise. Okay, capital gains taxes. Now, two final points. Number one, should we really care if we've got innovation in constrained firms? I mean, why not let big firms do it? Why not let the Microsofts of the world just gobble up the small firms or do all the innovation themselves? And by the way, that happens to some extent. I think there's several reasons to think that we should care specifically about how much environmental innovation is taking place in younger and smaller firms. One is just by construction. When you're constrained at the margin, you're foregoing projects with pretty high private benefits. Well, if the social returns are proportional to the private returns, then it almost by definition has to be the case that the social returns will be greater for the marginal investment that takes place in the constrained firms. Now, I don't know if in fact that's the case, but it's not crazy to think that that's the case. In addition, there's a lot of evidence that innovative activity in small and young firms in particular is important more broadly for productivity and economic growth. In particular, I mean, the workhorse endogenous growth models these days, it's all about innovation, the threat of innovation by otherwise constrained firms. They come in, and not only do they innovate, they force incumbents and large established firms to be more innovative. So final point. Questions and concerns that you may have even after if you agree that finance may matter, we're still left with a few things. Number one, suppose we have an increase in the availability of finance. The prediction would be some firms would be more innovative. But there's a concern out there from some prominent people. For example, Aggie and Acemoglu and so forth have a recent AER that I don't pretend to fully understand. But the question is, will the marginal innovation be sufficiently green? So do you want to just give firms another dollar of funds and let them invest it as they want? Or do we need some directed technical change? So the Agian and Acemoglu model says that directed technical change is actually optimal. But the challenge is, how do you direct this investment? So we can have tax credits and subsidies for R&D, but firms might just call stuff R&D today that wasn't R&D yesterday. It may not actually change the amount of investment. It also, we may have direct grants for R&D, but they may go to, you know, politically connected allies rather than the firms that are most constrained at the margin. And in addition, it may just crowd out private investment dollar for dollar. So it's tough to do directed policy to encourage this kind of activity. And even if you could do it, and this is an important point, I think, even if you could do it, it would be tough to convince people that you were actually being successful if you're the policymaker. And here's the reason. If you're doing this right, you should be funding projects that have a really high failure rate. If you're doing this right, you should be funding projects that may not have very big private returns, but the social returns are big. Those are the projects that are left on the table, right? The firms are going to take care of the ones with the really high private returns. So you look after the dollars are given to the firms. Number one, there's going to be a lot of examples that your political opponents can use to say, hey, look, something was funded that didn't work. And number two, if you try to ex post look at firm performance, so the firms that actually got the funds, how do they perform? You know what? It's not going to tell you anything if you want to evaluate the policy. What you'd like to know is something about what were the social returns from these innovations. But I have no idea how you go about measuring that and documenting that.
To find out more about free market environmentalism, visit www.perc.org.